Culpable is released every Monday and brought to you absolutely free. But for early binge access, ad-free listening, and exclusive content, subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus at tenderfootplus.com or on Apple Podcasts.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are solely those of the individuals interviewed and participating in the show and do not represent those of Tenderfoot TV. All individuals described or mentioned in the podcast should be considered innocent until found guilty in a court of law. This podcast contains subject matter such as violence, drug use, and other graphic descriptions, which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
It's infuriating, really, that there's been no movement or real effort to hold somebody responsible. There's enough there that DNA would make a difference. We can speculate, but until we know for sure, I think that's just a huge area that needs to be investigated. Why wouldn't they want to know? We've tried to go through them. We've tried to work with them. I mean, I've sent emails myself, like, begging. We just want to help. We just want answers. What does it hurt? You don't have to pay for it. Like, why would you be against that? If they're not going to help us, we'll just go around them.
We worked so hard and it feels like this is our chance.
When I received an email about Danny's case back in 2023, I have to admit, I didn't expect it would lead anywhere. It was a 25-year-old cold case with virtually no information available. But I figured, why not learn a little more about it, just in case? Then, through a series of events that I could have never predicted, what I'll refer to as a domino effect, everything changed. My goal with this case was the same as with any other, to solve it. And while we haven't met that end goal, not yet at least, it certainly feels within reach, like we need just one more piece to fall into place. To use that metaphor again, when you set up a domino run and give that first tile a nudge, there's joy in watching each one topple along the way. But at that same time, you're not really all that satisfied until you see the last domino fall. I'm obviously not playing games over here in my office. But staring down at all the black and white documents that have been spread across my desk for the past year or so, it kind of looks like it. It was never really my intent to get this lost in the weeds, but that's what needed to happen. I've now spent countless hours reviewing the case file, listening to old scratchy recordings and newer interviews, all containing very sensitive and important material. That said, I don't want the person at the center of it all to get lost in this. Danny's case has gone unsolved for longer than he lived on this earth, which is a tragedy in itself, and one of the reasons I felt so drawn to this story in the first place. But I've talked with enough people now to understand the impact he made in just a short time. So I'd like to switch gears for a moment here and take some time to honor him. A brief journey through Danny's life, from start to finish, with a little help from his family. Let's begin.
Here we go. Here comes Danny. Woo! I bet you're going to do your Superman.
Danny was born in San Diego, California, to his parents, Jane and Daniel. Daniel served in the Navy and was subject to lengthy deployments. So when Danny entered the picture, Jane assumed the honorable role of a stay-at-home mother, spending the majority of her time raising him, which seemed to be a rather eventful job.
Danny was the firstborn. He was very adventurous and bold. I always connected with him. We had the same sense of humor.
Hi, yes. Mike.
Hi, Danny.
Why are you wooing?
Over the next several years, the Violets would bounce around the globe, from California to Japan, back to California, having two more boys along the way, Drew and Ross. Eventually, they'd land in Willard, Ohio, where they'd plant their roots, which is when their daughter Caroline entered the picture. Willard was quite a change of pace from the more exotic places they'd lived previously, but Danny always had a knack for making the most out of life.
Yeah, there wasn't too much to do. We just rode around town, played tag, just get a game going, soccer, football, baseball, whatever. He's always joking around. We go to the pool pretty often. He would like, you know, he would throw us around. I knew he loved us and was our friend. Not just a brother, you know, but a friend.
His best quality would probably be that protective nature. Being a very small town, word gets around about little things that occur at school. And if I was picked on, or if Ross was picked on, or Caroline was picked on, he would always confront each of the perpetrators of whatever, like no matter how big or small. Danny was an excellent older brother to me and my other two siblings. They were just younger, so obviously he's not going to be hanging around with them with his friends, but he paid attention to them when he was on his own a lot more. He was a great big brother to my younger sister, who was an infant at the time.
There's Danny with his favorite sister. Danny loves Caroline.
Everyone always said that how much he loved me and babied me and doted on me. And I do remember that. Like, there's only one memory I have of him. He was trying to leave to go to his friends, but he was like, you know, playing with me. He was like throwing me on the couch or something. And I was loving it, having so much fun. And I'm like, no, stay, you know, play with me. And he like, you know, continued to play with me for a while. And I don't know, that always stuck out to me, that I knew he wanted to leave, but he didn't, because he knew I wanted him to stay.
While Caroline remembers the least out of the kids, being the youngest, they all have their own flashbacks. Drew recalls trips to the beach where Danny would run around like a madman, and football games that would get a little too physical. Ross tells me he'll never forget the time Danny rolled him down a flight of stairs on two skateboards while pointing to a scar on his chin. Their memories may vary, but they all describe Danny pretty much the same way. Strong, protective, fearless, just to name a few. He'd put these traits to good use after entering high school and finding what might have been his calling, the sport of wrestling.
Come on, Danny. That's a labia.
Everyone who knew Danny could attest, he was a natural. His family got to see it both in the gym and at home.
Yeah, he got me a couple times. He had me on the wrestling floor in the living room. I think he was about 15. And he put me in something that was all like a pretzel. And at the time, I was probably 190. He was 130. And he's throwing me around like a rag doll. He was a good wrestler.
He had loads of potential. And sadly, he was just starting to realize it. That's about when things started to change, arguably for the worse. He started drinking and dabbling in drugs. His grades dipped. Eventually, he'd suffer a manic episode at school that would lead to a diagnosis of bipolar disorder. And according to his family, the older he got, the more rebellious he became, causing tempers to flare around the house.
You know, obviously you're a parent, you're gonna get angry. And sometimes I probably went overboard. But what are you going to do? You can't be passive about it. And maybe you can be a little bit more tolerant, or more, not tolerant. Patient would be a better word, to try to de-escalate it. And sometimes I escalated it. I'm not pointing fingers at the kid, because I did the exact same thing, probably worse. I'm not any better than Danny was in that area.
The way Daniel puts it, the tough love came from a good place and from a place of experience. He cared about Danny, and he saw his potential. He couldn't just let him continue to make the choices he was making. The problem was, he didn't know how to stop it, and neither did Jane. Both parents admit to feeling a sense of helplessness at times, because it didn't seem like anyone could get through to him, no matter their approach. They regret that things didn't really end on the best of notes, but they were trying their best to reel him in. On Saturday, October 24th, 1998, Danny left home abruptly. It wasn't really all that concerning at first, until a day had passed, and there was still no sign of him. Then came another, and another.
Well, so yeah, those were hard days, obviously. I mean, we got to kind of go through our day to day. It's just Danny's just missing. So that was a very strange time. My parents were very down and depressed. Like every day that would go by, less and less hope, I guess. So things were very edgy around the house at a personal level. And then going to school, rumors, people talking about who's seen him and this and that.
The family did their best to keep hope and block out all the rumors, waiting for him to walk back through that door. But sadly, he never came. Instead, 11 days into his disappearance, Daniel got a different visitor on his doorstep, the last kind you hope to see. It was a Willard police officer. Danny, their oldest son, had just been discovered dead in a nearby cornfield. Daniel tried his best to keep his composure in front of the kids while he placed a call to Jane. She was working as a teacher at the time.
So the principal came to my room and said, "You're needed at home." I looked at him and I said, "Well, maybe it's about Danny." I said, "Let me talk to him." He just looked at me and said, "No, go. Go now." And I don't even remember driving. I just made it home. And I came up to the house and our pastor was on the steps and Dan was on the steps. And he said, "He's dead, Jane. They killed him." And I just said, "No, there's no way." And just started crying.
From this point on, everything changed for the Violet family. No one can plan for something as tragic as this. There's no proper way of responding to the news. You just handle it the best you can, one thing at a time. And sadly, for Jane and Daniel, that meant breaking the news to the kids. They'd been there inside the house throughout all the commotion. And while two of them may not have been old enough to really comprehend it, the writing was on the walls.
The three of them were sitting in the living room. And so we had to go in and tell them. And they didn't react. Like they had no idea what to say or what to do.
The only thing I remember was looking over at Drew and Ross, and they didn't really move, didn't do anything, so that's what I did. And then after they said that we could go, we all went like separate ways. I went in my room and cried, and that's all I remember from that. And then I remember, like, even at the funeral, I had to like hide that I was crying. I don't, we didn't show it, you know. I did whatever my brothers did, and they both were very stoic and just didn't show that they were hurting, so I thought that's what I had to do. And that's kind of how we dealt with it.
Everything became a blur after this, especially for the two youngest, Ross and Caroline, who were just 10 and 6 at the time. Drew seems to remember the most out of the siblings. He was a little older, at 13. He tells me he moved into Danny's bedroom shortly after his passing and can recall spending countless hours in there.
I just shut down. I didn't say anything to anybody for a long time. But I basically camped out in that room all day, every day. I hardly came out to eat or shower or do anything for a really long time. His friends would come in, I would just act like I'm sleeping or something. You know, I didn't talk to anybody.
As the days passed, Jane and Daniel tried to get answers, but didn't have much luck. It was an active investigation. They were at the mercy of the sheriff's office. So they placed their trust in authorities and did their best to move on with life. Despite the nightmare they were trapped in, they still had three other kids to raise, as well as jobs and other responsibilities to tend to.
I was in a very busy period at that point because I was finishing my degree. Then I started subbing. I always felt like I had kept busy and just pushed everything away and didn't really deal with it. If I had just been home at that time, I don't know, it would have been tough because there's so little you can control. There's so little you can do. who's got the roadmap for what you do when your kid dies? Who's written the book that says what to do now? Because I felt like I was on display and I didn't know how I was supposed to act. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. You know, we all just kind of floundered. We all just lived the life we had.
Jane and Daniel divorced in 2000, and sometime later, they both remarried. Daniel would eventually move to Hawaii with his wife, while Jane and her husband stayed in Ohio. The kids all grew into adults and started careers. Now, they have kids of their own. And for all that time, 25 years in total, they hardly even talked about Danny's death. Not that it didn't weigh on them with each passing day. I can assure you it did. And they'd always take time to remember him on his birthday and even around the time of his passing. But the more challenging topics, how he died or what they think happened, those kinds of things were never really discussed. Thankfully, that started changing in 2023 when the first few dominoes fell.
Well, since it's been coming out, the podcast, they've been researching so much of this information and getting more answers. There's been a lot more family discussion about it. Drew was right that we just never really talked about it, but what could you say? You know, it's hard when you're expected to be the one with the answers and you don't know.
I don't really feel like there's moral victories in a story like this, but at the same time, it's been encouraging to see the family become more united in this over the past couple years. More open to talking about it amongst themselves, even the hard stuff. In fact, they're now more involved in this than ever before, thanks to all the recent interest in Danny's case. Jane gives a lot of that credit to Danielle for all the work she's put in, and that email she sent me, which set everything into motion. The first time I met with the family, it was one by one, from the comfort of their own homes. The next time I'd see them, it would be at a vigil, organized by none other than Danielle. And this time, they'd all be together in one place, by the clock tower in downtown Willard, for the 26th anniversary of Danny's passing.
Hello.
Hello.
There's a picture. And there's several in there, like this.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Oh, Regina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her brother.
The vigil was actually in honor of two victims, Danny Violet and Regina Hicks. I'd heard a lot about Regina's case while working on this story, an absolute tragedy. The 25-year-old was killed in 2001, nearly 3 years to the day after Danny's death. Her body was found inside her car, which was submerged in a nearby pond. Her cause of death was said to be drowning, but she had several injuries that were not attributed to the car accident. All these years later, her family, similar to Danny's, are still doing everything they can to keep her memory alive. In no time at all, the large concrete slab and surrounding field ballooned from just a handful of people to 60 or more. I tried my best to meet with as many folks as I could in the short window I had. Most of them were new faces, but there was also some familiar faces.
Is there a big crew you guys coming?
I'm not sure. Dr. Curtis should be here soon.
Nice.
I was shocked when I noticed a group of young adults seated on a brick landing beside me, who I'd seen once before. The Tiffin University sweaters were a bit of a giveaway. I know Professor Michael Curtis isn't one to settle, but I can't imagine that attending vigils is part of the curriculum there. But they came nonetheless, a true testament of their passion for this. And the university's newest Provost Award winner is right there with them.
Jane, this is Michael Curtis. He's the doctor
nice
that leads the cold
you.
Case fellowship.
Thank you
nice
so much for taking it.
Absolutely. It's our honor to take on the case. And hopefully we can reach some type of resolution, right?
Yes. Yeah. And amen.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure that it's been very difficult for you.
For a minute, I stopped to look around and admire the large gathering of people in this quiet town. Some mourning, some laughing. But I noticed that one person in particular was missing, understandably. Danny's father was unable to make the trip. It turns out, taking a flight from Hawaii to Ohio on short notice is no easy feat. But then I glanced over and saw that Ross was speaking with someone on FaceTime. It was Daniel. He was there in spirit, looking on. As I turned back towards the crowd, I see Danielle approach the stage and position herself next to a table that she and Jane had arranged with photos of both the victims.
Okay, everybody.
All the chatter quickly turns to silence, and she begins to speak.
First, I want to thank you all for being here tonight to honor the memories of Danny Violet and Regina Roe Hicks. Thank you for supporting their loved ones in their continued fight for justice. Danny was a loyal, adventurous teenager. He took his role of big brother seriously and was the type of friend who would take the blame before letting someone he cared about get in trouble. He was loved unconditionally, and in many ways his life was just beginning before it abruptly ended October 24th, 1998, at just 17 years old. Regina Roe Hicks was a beloved daughter, sister, friend, and mother. Those who knew her describe her as good-hearted, giving, and family-oriented. She was a devoted, loving mother to her son. Like Danny, she should have had decades of life ahead of her, but that was unfairly taken from her in October of 2001 at just 25 years old. All death is hard, but the loss of young, innocent life through foul play is especially tragic and difficult to accept. To the family and friends of both Danny and Regina, I am in awe of how brave, resilient, and amazing you are. The commitment and love you show for Danny and Regina 20 plus years later not only honors their memory, but it also allows people who never got to meet them to know how special and important they were and still are. I know I speak for many when I say we support you in your fight for justice, and you are not alone. Together we are stronger, and we won't give up. Please join me in lighting a candle in their honor.
If you would, please bow your heads for a word of prayer. Loving and just God, we gather here today with heavy hearts to remember and honor the lives of Danny Violet and Regina Hicks. Father, we thank you for the gift.
In my opinion, there may be no better way of honoring a victim and helping their memory live on than a vigil like this. A break from all the real horrors that these people live with day in and day out. The loss, the lack of answers, the gory details that jog their minds. For a moment, it's simply about remembering them, which is all the more important with each year that passes without resolution. Just when I thought things were about to wrap up for the evening, Danielle asks if anyone else would care to speak, and I see Jane, a very reserved and passive woman, who was even a bit hesitant to engage with me at first meeting, step up onto the stage.
I just want to say a very sincere thank you to everyone who is here and everyone who has been showing support for this effort. I especially want to thank Danielle and her husband as well, who have been so dogged at staying at this and collecting facts and learning more and more, and for the professionals who are helping from the college and the podcast, and just so many people who don't let this go. They stay right with it, and everybody here, I appreciate so much that you are doing that for my son.
Love you, Jane.
Seeing the family all huddled together, along with Danielle and Eric, Michael and his fellowship, and all the folks who gathered on this evening, was pretty surreal. And as the clock tower chimed in Willard's Roy Doster Plaza, I couldn't help but think how much has changed over just a short time, and wonder what could be the next domino to fall. In Regina's case, just 6 months after the vigil, an arrest was made. Her ex-husband, Paul Hicks, was indicted on 3 counts of murder and 1 count of kidnapping, news that her family and friends had been waiting on for far too long. As for Danny, his case remained unsolved, but in some ways, Regina's story offered some hope, a reminder that it's never too late to see a break in a case, or furthermore, to see it solved. Which brings me to some more recent news in Danny's case, something that's actually been in the works for nearly a year now, that we hope will lead to some answers. Towards the end of 2024, Danny's family, with some help from Danielle, started inquiring about the physical evidence that had been preserved in this case and the prospect of having it retested by a third party. After learning about advancements in DNA testing and seeing case after case, some far older than Danny's, being solved through newer methods, they felt like it could be worth a shot. The list of items includes his shirt, jeans, underwear, wallet, fingernail clippings, and semen obtained from a rectal swab. The family would eventually reach out to Sorensen Forensics, a private DNA analysis laboratory, and they'd learn that all of these items could in fact be retested, with the majority being through the MVAC system, a wet vacuum method that has proven to be highly effective at obtaining DNA profiles. While the technology has been around for some time, it wasn't widely used in cold cases or validated by forensic laboratories until 2014. After learning this, the family requested a quote from Sorensen, just to see what it would even cost. I think we were all expecting a rather large and possibly unattainable number. But when I received a call from Danielle about it, she came with some good news.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey.
What you got for me?
Cut out there for a second. The forensics estimate, it's less than $6,000. It costs less than our transmission estimate on our van right now. I'm through the roof. Excited.
That's awesome. And that's
Can you believe it? Everything.
That is crazy.
Yeah. I thought $50,000, and I thought that was going to be a conservative estimate. I mean, that's fingers crossed, wishful thinking on my part, but with a number like that, it seems possible. I'm going to give it my very best shot. See if I can't get this paid for.
On the heels of this call, Danielle made a post on the Justice for Danny page to try and raise money for the testing, and donations started pouring in immediately. Then she and Eric took it a step further, setting up a table at Willard's week-long sesquicentennial event, a 150-year celebration, in case you were wondering. And they'd keep at it until the bill was footed. Eventually, they'd send an email to Lieutenant Duncan with the Huron County Sheriff's Office, attaching an estimate from Sorensen, shipping instructions for the evidence, and an email of approval they'd received from Huron County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Jacob Stevens. Everything was moving in the right direction. Then, all that momentum came to a halt. Duncan informed the family there are many more considerations and requirements that need to be addressed before the evidence can be sent off. He also asked if the family had legal counsel to represent them in the matter. They respond, asking for more clarity on the next steps, waiting weeks for a reply back. And in the meantime, they took the initiative and asked Professor Michael Curtis if he could be their legal counsel. He obliged. Michael reached out to Lieutenant Duncan and Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Stevens to ask what next steps we need to take to get this testing done. Weeks pass with no reply. He follows up yet again, and this time is able to schedule a meeting with Stevens on February 21st, 2025. I called Danielle and Michael that day to see what was learned and received a rather deflating response.
Well, Stevens is homesick today, so he bailed on the phone call on the deadline date.
Okay.
You know, I always like to think that there's good faith, but I'm starting to believe that there isn't.
This is the unresponsiveness is the weirdest thing.
It's so weird, dude. Like, I'll jump through whatever hoops they tell me to jump through. I'll do cartwheels, I'll do backflips. I'll do whatever you want me to do, but nothing. So we'll see.
It was at this point that the family had to start considering legal action, something they were hoping to avoid at all costs. They were frustrated over the lack of response from Huron County and felt they'd made it too far and done too much work of their own, researching, finding a lab, and raising money to hit this kind of roadblock.
It's infuriating, really, that there's been no movement or real effort to hold somebody responsible. What does it hurt? You don't have to pay for it. It's more advanced. The BCI does not, the Ohio BCI at least, does not have an MVAC. Like, they don't even have one. We're doing everything that you can do and more. Why would you be against that? If they're not going to help us, we'll just go around them. We've worked so hard and it feels like this is our chance.
A few months passed and sadly nothing changed. The only difference was that we'd all grown a little more frustrated because what seemed so promising just months earlier all of a sudden was starting to feel like a pipe dream. Michael was fed up at this point and called me one day to vent about it.
I call it a classic too many chiefs and not enough Indians kind of scenario, right? Too many people talk and too many people chirping. So I said, let me be the contact point. Let me get a hold of the prosecutor and communicate. And I shoot him an email saying, hey, look, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is how I'm involved. I'm going to be the guy that you need to contact from here on out. So we set up a meeting and he outlines what he wants. He wants to know the lab. He wants to know their process. He wants to know their accreditation. He wants to know what type of testing they're going to do. And so I say, okay, I'm going to get all of that for you. I connect them. I introduce them by email. Hey, this is Suzanne. Suzanne, this is the prosecuting attorney. This is the guy you're going to be working with. I'm out. Crickets. I know she's called them and left messages twice. Sent emails. Nope. Nothing. And I don't know this guy's schedule. Maybe he's super busy. But you can return an email, dude. Hey, man. Still on it? Thinking about it? I'd be happier with an F off. Hey, Mike, we don't recognize you. We get that you're a professor at Tiffin. Nobody gives a shit. I'd rather get that.
Keep in mind, the frustrations here were not simply due to the holdup in testing. That was the main source of it. But it was also because Michael and his fellowship had worked diligently throughout the semester and believed they had information that could be further validated with the results of that testing, assuming they were able to get a hit.
I feel like I know what happened. Actually, I've been told what's happened. And it's a credible source, and it's somebody that I think that doesn't really have any vested interest in it, nor do I think that it's anybody that's trying to get something out of it. I feel like we've settled on some people and that the testing is going to be the ultimate determinant of where that goes. My argument is, listen to what I've heard and what I found out, and you decide for yourself, what do you think it is? Is it enough to reopen it? I think if you get a DNA hit, I think it's enough to reopen it and look at it again. You see it every day in the news. The technology is so advanced now. They're solving these cases that are 60 years old. Why withhold it? We're paying for it. We have the check written, ready to go. It's already paid for. If it's closed and you don't intend to reopen it, what are you worried about?
I don't necessarily believe that the Huron County Sheriff's Office was worried about getting the testing done, but it's a fair question to ask given the circumstances. I'm no professional here, so I can't speak on how this process should play out or the timeliness of it all. Frankly, this was all new to me. But I can agree with Michael's sentiment here. It's hard when you make all the right steps and take something as far as you can just to run into a wall.
I was so optimistic and I was like, dude, we're gonna solve this. I was telling people like, man, we're so close. And here we are, and my students are pissed. I'm like, well, hey, listen, you're at the whim of bureaucracy. Like, this is frustrating. I keep coming up with reasons to give them grace. I'm out of them. And, you know, I love law enforcement. I love prosecutors. I love my brothers in blue. I know they're out there trying to do a good job and doing the best that they can. But this isn't acceptable.
This was a very low point for all of us, but especially for Danny's family. While the testing may have been a long shot in the first place, at the end of the day, it was still a huge opportunity, as there's really no telling what could have come from it. But ultimately, it had started to feel like it may never happen. Then, just as all hope was lost, there came a turning point.
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm okay. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Yes, it was a big day yesterday, so talk to me.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like they're going to do the testing. And if the DNA comes back to a profile, they will reopen the case.
Thank you. In July of 2025, Danielle informed me that she'd just gotten out of a very encouraging meeting with Lieutenant Duncan, Detective Gillum, and Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Jacob Stevens of Huron County. Jane, her husband Scott, Drew, his wife Andrea, Danielle's husband Eric, and Michael Curtis were also present. The major takeaways from that meeting: Huron County recognized the importance of getting the evidence tested and said they'll do what they can to try and make that happen. They also spoke on the possibility of reopening Danny's case based on the results of the testing and any new information that comes in, including any recently obtained leads and tips that we'd gathered over the past year or so. In this meeting, Gillum asserted himself as the lead investigator moving forward and expressed to the group that he wants to help them get to the bottom of this. While none of this was a done deal per se, it was at least enough to provide optimism and showed that they do care about Danny's case and that he hasn't been forgotten about in all of this, which is really all that the Violets ever wanted out of law enforcement. And speaking with the family, who are now approaching 27 years without justice for Danny, they reflected on this whole journey, what's still an ongoing process, and took some time to speak on the impact he's made on each of them, and ultimately, what they hope will come from all of this.
It's quite different for each of us because I was very close to my brother and I was the oldest. So in that sense, I guess it's been hardest on me. Ross, he's been broken up about it. I think that's what's gotten him into the work he's doing, social work and trying to help others in any way that he can. He's very good at what he does. In my sister's case, she's just been lost her whole life as far as she doesn't have really any memory of it. And then learning more and more about it as she's gotten older and having no answers and being very confused in that state. So she's being frustrated in that way. I am done with not knowing, you know, and I'm done with being, we might figure it out. If anybody did know something, I would hope that after this amount of time that's passed, that they would have the decency, I guess, to come out and tell our family to help us have the closure that we're looking for in my brother's case.
This was Drew's whole reason for speaking with me, a stranger, in the first place. He was the first family member I spoke with and has always been the most dogged about solving his brother's case. While the younger siblings never invested quite as much thought over the years or maybe quite as much effort into finding answers, I'm happy to say they stand more in alignment on this than ever before.
I think the person who did something accidental or not, they knew him. I've always believed, when I started giving it some thought, there's definitely something fishy going on. Somebody's protecting somebody. But why? Justice will be served in this life or the next. But I've come to terms with it. Give to God and just try to live my life the way that I think Danny would want me to live it. I know he's looking down on me. As flawed as we are as a family, I think he's proud of us with just how we're living our lives. I'm currently grateful that all this is happening and our family is coming closer, finally, because of it.
Of course, part of me has always wanted to know, but I've never really felt like I wanted to be the one to investigate it or whatever. You know, it's, you know, even with the podcast and stuff, I'm learning stuff I didn't really want to know about it. I will say it helped me remember how much I missed him because I kind of forgot about that. You know, it's different now because it's been so long. But I do know I missed him so much. No. And it always felt kind of strange because it's like, it feels like I'm missing a stranger almost, you know? And then now that I'm older, since all this started and we've had the vigils and stuff and, you know, seeing his friends, seeing Eric with his kids, like, makes me happy because, you know, he's a great dad and Danielle's a great mom. And but it, you know, just makes me sad that he'll never gets to have a family. And, you know, just thinking about where he could have been. being the same age as them and stuff, it's hard to see him sometimes.
In some ways, I think the grieving process has really just begun for the Violet family, having conversations amongst themselves, reflecting on old memories of Danny, and seeing so much renewed interest from folks who were once strangers to them, has led to a flood of emotion, causing each of them to look back on this with so many what-ifs, which can't be captured any better than this seemingly divine story that Daniel had to share.
There was a song on the radio one day. It's called Forever 17. It's by Zoe Girl. Now, obviously, that song could apply to anybody that is 17 that died. Now, fast forward a year or two later, they have a big concert down in Mansfield, Ohio, called a Fog Fest. And that group was there. And we went backstage and met them, got their autograph, and told them about Danny's story. And they were like, it happened to her friends, and it happened to my son. But you'll understand what I'm talking about when you hear that song.
I want to read some of the lyrics. I'll never have a bed to make, a test to take, a summer day. I'll always be forever 17. I could have had a family if things had worked out differently. Instead, I'll be forever 17. Could I have just one more day, a chance to learn from my mistakes? Can someone wake me up? I haven't lived yet. I'm only 17.
Not a real happy song, it's kind of a sad song. You know, everybody thinks this is what would have happened. And that whole song talks about all that stuff. What if this happened, or what could have happened?
If you knew that Danny was listening to this interview, is there anything that you'd want to say to him in this moment?
Oof, that's a hard, that's... I was fine until I started speaking.
Daniel mutes the call to collect himself, and I apologize for upsetting him. After a brief pause, he starts to muster up some words.
The question is not necessarily getting me upset. It's the answer I want to give without, you know, getting too emotional. I'm going to say this fast, so don't get... It's not, I'm trying to do it without crying. I love you, Danny. I miss you. And I'll see you someday.
It's been hard to see what it's done to the family, to each member has been impacted. And his friends were so impacted. They all struggled with life after that. So the devastation, just the loss of watching his friends go on to marry and to have kids, and he's not doing any of those things. He would have found somebody special who would have helped him to straighten out his life, and he'd be a great dad. I remember him telling me he wanted a child when he was 18. I said, Danny, that's fine, honey, but once you have that child, everything you have will go to that child. What you want does not matter anymore. He goes, well, maybe not when I'm 18.
I had that same feeling at about that same age, and I was fortunate to meet somebody who straightened me out, because I was going to need to do that first before I... Any kids?
That's right. Once those kids come along, they're what matters. You know, nothing matters as much as that, as love. We still love him. We have always loved him. He's my little boy. He'll always be my little boy.
Jane's final reminder to me, love your family and hold them tight. And when things are at their worst, don't ever lose hope.
What has all this been like, going from not talking about it a lot and kind of just caring for it with life to now you probably feel like you can't really escape it?
It feels like there's finally a possibility that we'll get some answers. And I haven't felt that way in a long, long time. It feels like there's real interest, there's real work going into it. And it might bear fruit. It would not have happened without some light being shed.
For more than 25 years, the Violet family has waited for answers about what happened to Danny. What has felt like an eternity of confusion, silence, and closing of doors. When I started following this story a couple years ago, I hoped that somehow, some way, I could help turn that tide and possibly bring resolution to this once and for all. And if we've learned anything in this, it's that you never know when that next domino will fall. Just a few days ago, on September 9th, I received a text from Danielle, one we'd been waiting on for quite some time. Her message was even shorter and sweeter than that first one she sent me about Danny's case some time ago, the one that set all of this into motion. Her message read, "The evidence has been sent and received by the lab, which led to a collective sigh of relief from each and every one of us." Again, there's no telling whether or not this will provide answers, but it's another step in the right direction. And at the end of the day, it certainly could bring answers. Only time will tell. With that said, there are still other ways we can help bring resolution to this. To anyone listening, whether you've been holding on to some information for years or something clicked for you while listening to this series, now is the time to come forward. If you have any information that you think could help, please reach out. It doesn't matter how small or insignificant you feel it may be. You never know. It could be just the piece that authorities need to finally put this case to rest. We're offering $10,000 for any information that can help lead to conviction or answers in this case. You can contact us through the form on our website at culpablepodcast.com or leave a message on our tip line, 470-300-0238. Or you can contact the Huron County Sheriff's Office by calling 419-668-6912. While this may be the end of things for now, I can tell you this story is far from over. We will continue to await the results of testing and review any tips or leads that come through. If there's a break in the case or any newsworthy material comes about, I assure you, you'll be the first to know it. Until next time. Culpable is a production of Tenderfoot TV in partnership with Odyssey, written and hosted by Dennis Cooper. Executive producers are Donald Albright and Payne Lindsay. Our senior producer is John Street. Our producer is Jamie Albright. Edit, mix, and sound design by Dayton Cole. Our theme song is by Dirt Poor Robbins, with additional score by Makeup and Vanity Set and Dayton Cole. Special thanks to Oren Rosenbaum, the team at UTA, and the Nord Group. You can follow us on social media at Culpable Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please take time to follow, rate, and review. Your feedback is greatly appreciated. For more podcasts like Culpable, search Tenderfoot TV on your favorite podcast app or visit tenderfoot.tv. And lastly, if you have any information about the death of Danny Violet, please fill out the form on our website, culpablepodcast.com.
You can also contact the Huron County Sheriff's Office at 419-668-6912 or submit an anonymous tip through the Huron County Sheriff's Office app. Thanks for listening. A new episode of Culpable will release next Monday, but you can binge additional episodes right now, ad-free, by subscribing to Tenderfoot Plus on Apple Podcasts or at tenderfootplus.com.
Do you know that feeling when you're at happy hour with your friends and you listen to them monologue about their current fixation or their work drama, and you just think to yourself, God, I love my friends. I could listen to this forever. Well, I do. And that is why 10 years ago, I started a podcast with my best friend, Julia Schifini, who loves to yap about Greek myths, creepypasta, and death. That is, in fact, what you can find every week on our podcast, Spirits, where we pour a drink every single week and learn about a new story from around the world. That includes urban legends, ancient myths, modern folklore, all through a queer feminist lens of two people who are figuring out life and love each other along the way. So if you want spooky stories from our listeners' hometowns, haunted old spaghetti factory, anyone, or deep dives with brilliant scholars about everything from disability and folklore to ancient Sumerian religion to the myths of AI supremacy, you will get it on Spirits. Subscribe now or go to spiritspodcast.com for more.